Chapter 1. Nothing about Christmas appealed to Cornelius Smith, at least not in the usual sense. A man of science, he found the Christmas season to be a time of superstition and exaggeration, of hyperbole and overspending, a time given to the cheap commercialization of symbols now so distant and misinterpreted as to have been rendered meaningless. Well, before dawn, he tiptoed out of his parents' home, sliding out the side door noiselessly. Yesterday, his folks had welcomed him, knowing he'd only stay one night before heading out for his adventure trip, and then return to spend Christmas with them. Though every square inch of their modest home now bulged with festive items, he'd admired his mother's handiwork. Then he and his dad had stepped into the garage to check over the car he'd given them a few months earlier. The brand new silver GM EV1 sat gleaming beside its home charging unit, tethered by its cord, paddle plugged into the hood. Cornelius drove it himself when he came to visit to cut down on emissions, offsetting as much as possible the combustion engine vehicle he needed for reaching the mountain observatories he frequented. Meanwhile, the high-tech electric car had become his dad's pride and joy, and an endless source of scientific conversation both men enjoyed. Now, smiling at the remembrance, Cornelius sat high in the driver's seat of his Dodge Durango, creeping as quietly as this vehicle would allow down the still-slumbering Main Street. He allowed that, at 5 a.m. on this otherwise bleak morning the day before Christmas Eve, the decorative lights had some charm. The huge window panes of Finder's Gallery were filled with multicolored glass sculptures, all lit from behind, sending forth a rainbow of light into the darkened lane. He slowed enough to peer into a store called Shell Shock, which he didn't remember seeing before. In its window stood a Christmas tree made entirely of seashells, with a large starfish adorning its top. When he came to buy the book bookshop, which had been there as long as Cornelius could remember, he brought his vehicle to a stop and idled while he took in the details. This year, the owner had created an extraordinary diorama, a miniature street from Charles Dickens's London extended across the interior of the large paned window, complete with tiny horses and carriages, doll citizens in top hats and bonnets, and among the storefronts he saw the Little Dorrit bookshop. Charles Dickens himself would recognize the street in a trice. But soon enough, daylight would begin to wash over the town of Milford Haven, revealing the artificiality of its gaudy displays, and Cornelius felt eager to leave it all behind for a day. Come tomorrow, he'd be joining his parents for all the merriment of the season, and he had to admit he'd enjoy it for their sakes. But for him, the finest winter had to offer was the deep quiet of falling snow, the hollow thud of a heavy branch dropping its sodden weight, the pulsing wet nose of a doe foraging for food. All these delights hovered far from civilization, and he edged his car onto California Highway 1. Watching the last of the town disappear in his rearview mirror, he shook his head at the garish blinking of a neon motel sign.
"Folks just need to make a living," he could hear his father say.
For Cornelius, the living was eked out from the dribbles and drabs of government grants. Though employed by NASA, his lot as a scientist was forever having to prove the worth of his experiments in practical applications. Fewer and fewer were the opportunities for pure research, another sad commentary on today's world. How could a scientist look for something he didn't yet know existed? The most startling discoveries were often made by accident, though he considered that to be a misnomer. Accidental finds were in fact serendipitous discovery, and one had to be living a life of curiosity and open-mindedness in order to notice the anomaly that so often signaled hidden treasure. As he turned his head, his eye caught the movement of the angel hanging from his rearview mirror, and he snorted at himself in the green glow of his dashboard lights.
It was his one concession to childhood Christmases, the little stained glass angel his mother had given him long ago. In her honor, he dutifully hung it in his car every December, her birthday month, and his. Dangling from its tiny gold rope, it swayed now with open arms, holding a star in one hand. "Well, Mom," he thought, "the joke's on me." Though he knew the roads well enough, whenever possible, Cornelius used stellar navigation, trusting the stars more than Earth-based information. Craning his neck out the driver's side window, he took his bearings. Clear skies, 4:15 a.m., Pacific Standard Time. Ursa Majoris, with a level dipper, should be high overhead, with Orion the Hunter just finishing his leap lower in the western sky. "Check," he said to himself. Although he'd intended using the stars only to help him negotiate the mere ripples on a small planet in a familiar solar system, he found he could not easily shut off the exercise of mentally expanding the view from his present location. To the west, Mars shone brightly in the sky. "Where's Jupiter now?" he asked himself, the answer coming almost immediately. "Off my right toe." Calculating that if he drew a line from himself to Jupiter, it would pass through the constellation Pavonis, the peacock, in the southern hemisphere. 2 hours later, Cornelius steadied the steering wheel while sipping fresh coffee from his travel mug. His visor shielded his eyes from the blaze of sun blasting over the edge of the eastern mountains. Having checked the map, he pleasured in the surge of the Durango's powerful engine as it labored up into the foothills. As his vehicle climbed through 3,000 feet, he glanced at the car's digital clock. 6:49 a.m. He looked to his left in time to see the full moon, now a disk of luminous tissue, hung on a floating curtain of pale lavender. He chuckled. "It's as if she's peering over the western slopes, caught in her gossamer peignoir." Now he stole a glance to the right. Through gaps between the mountains, a red haze lifted off the eastern horizon. Normally, the rising sun signaled the end of his workday, so he got a thrill from the feeling he was playing hooky by having a daylight adventure. In cities, artists claim the night for their own. He imagined jazz musicians sequestered in smoky clubs and actors peeling off grease paint in the wee hours. In the wild, the night was the purview of nocturnal hunters padding on huge, silent feet through forest and ravine. But for the astronomer, night was simply the closest thing to reality one could get while being earthbound. Daylight existed as an inconvenient maintenance function the planet needed to regenerate her ecosystem. Like a cloak Earth had to wear to mask her identity, blue sky concealed her context and location, and blocked out neighbors both near and far, leaving her isolated in her lonely corner of space. Passionate about his work, Cornelius usually found himself impatient for the dimming of the intrusive rays from that nearest star so he could be about his nightly tasks. But the season invited breaks in routine with celebrations of many kinds, and he did enjoy visiting the little church for Christmas service with his parents. However, today, he would follow a secret tradition of celebrating Christmas in his own way. If there was a ceremony he would choose to join, it would probably be the Chumash Winter Solstice, a time of quiet contemplation and deep silences, even in the midst of large gatherings. But he would celebrate with rocks and trees and with largely unseen animal companions whom he would do his best not to disturb. As Cornelius continued to follow the snaking highway, the mountains seemed to welcome him like relatives at a family reunion, as though they'd posted sentinels to guide him home. Thick brown yucca spires sprouted from prickly ruffs at even intervals along the roadside. Passing a sign that read, "Double Fine," he laughed. Indeed, that's just how things were today. Double Fine. As he climbed through 5,000 feet, The colors of dawn were shifting so rapidly, they proved hard to describe.
It really looks like a painting. In fact, I remember seeing one with clouds something like this.
In a gallery in Milford Haven, he'd noticed the work of the local artist Miranda Jones, a painter of wildlife and nature scenes. He'd tried to imagine how she'd interpret the mountains in front of him now. The ridges closest to him were mottled browns, but just one ridge away, they mysteriously took on an azure blue cast.
She'd know how to capture them, he thought, marveling at the artistic talent beyond his ken.
Then he caught a familiar sight, a gleaming white observatory crouched in a metal forest of broadcast towers. The place was incalculably rich in astronomical history. From here, Michelson and Morley had bounced light off the nearby Mount Baldy, the highest peak in the region. When they used the terrain as a natural reflecting device, their results led directly to Einstein's theory of relativity.
As if this weren't enough, it was here on a mountaintop overlooking Los Angeles that the first 100-inch telescope had been built in 1918.
And 60 years ago, looking through that very lens, Hubble discovered the universe was expanding.
The universe has expanded over 340 trillion miles since then, he calculated. And that's not including Einstein's acceleration theory. Time flies.
Laughing at his own joke, he realized how true that little aphorism had proven in his own life. As a grad student, he'd spent over 150 nights at Mount Wilson, peering at the night sky, tracking the spinning cosmos.
That was a long time ago, and it was only yesterday.
He brought his mind back to the road in front of him and wound the Durango past the Mount Wilson turnoff. As he continued his ascent, sunlight crested over the eastern ridges, its red slanting rays passing through tree branches, which seemed momentarily to catch fire.
Perish the thought, he whispered to himself,
fearing for the forest long suffering in California's current drought. The native chaparral, designed to recede only by exploding in the extreme heat of flames, seemed a built-in disaster waiting to happen. And yet, who was he to doubt the design of nature? Fondly, he noted the sign for the Buckhorn Area Turnout, where he'd camped several times. And then at 7:10, sunlight smacked the windshield, and Cornelius reached for his sunglasses, grinning at the pristine snow whitening the mountaintops. At 6,000 feet, he saw the first sign of the Pacific Crest Trail, which stretched all the way from Canada to Mexico. Two consecutive tunnels brought him to the windiest portion of the highway, and his tires squealed at the sharper hairpin turns. Not long after passing a sign that read, "On the crest, safety is best," appropriately enough, he saw a ranger's vehicle winding its way down the mountain. Squinting, he realized it was his longtime acquaintance, Perry Landau, and managed to wave before the two vehicles passed each other. Slowing around the next bend, Cornelius looked for his turnout. "Eagle's Roost Campsite," the sign said, and he angled the big vehicle carefully down a steep, unpaved road. After stopping to drop a small fee into a locked cash box, he chose a campsite and parked in the shade of a towering lodgepole pine. Stretching as he stood, he lifted the tailgate and hoisted his oversized duffel. Finding a level spot next to a fire ring, he pitched his tent, then zipped it closed and wrote his name on the site marker. His lodging for tonight secured, he climbed back into the Durango, then continued up the Angeles Crest Highway to the Mount Baden-Powell Turnout. He parked, then checked his hiking gear, and pulled on another layer of clothing in case he needed it at altitude. At 9:30, Cornelius headed out of the parking lot, beginning the long climb to the top of the mountain. "Hazardous trail during winter months," a sign admonished. "Steep, icy slopes." The warning scarcely seemed to apply to this morning. Brilliant blue sky, light breeze through the trees, warm sun on his face.